rescue and safe return of Adian Ash River, the Wolf of the North. Chapter 8. Manon Blackbeak, heir of the Blackbeak Witch Clan, bearer of the Blade Windcleaver, rider of the Wyvern Abraxos, and wingleader of the King of Otterland's aerial host, stared at the portly man sitting across the black glass table and kept her temper on a tight leash. In the weeks that Manon and half the Iron Teeth Legion had been stationed in Morath, the mountain stronghold of Duke Parrington, she had not warmed to him. Neither had any of her 13. Which was why Asterin's hands were within easy reach of her twin blades as she leaned against the dark stone wall, why Sorrel was posted near the doors, and why Vesta and Lynn stood guard outside them. The Duke either didn't notice or didn't care. He showed interest in Manon only when giving orders about her host's training. Other than that, he appeared relentlessly focused on the army of strange-smelling men that waited in the camp at the foot of the mountain, or on whatever dwelled under the surrounding mountains, whatever screamed and roared and moaned within the labyrinth of catacombs carved into the heart of the ancient rock. Manon had never asked what was kept or done inside those mountains, though her shadows had reported whispers of stone altars stained with blood, and dungeons blacker than the darkness itself. If it didn't interfere with the Iron Teeth Legion, Manon didn't particularly care. Let these men play at being gods. Usually, though, especially in these wretched meetings, the Duke's attention was fixed upon the beautiful raven-haired woman who was never far from his side, as though tethered to him by an invisible chain. It was to her that Manon now looked, while the Duke pointed out the areas on the map he wanted Iron Teeth scouts to survey. Caltaine. That was her name. She never said anything. Never looked at anyone. A dark collar was clasped around her moon-white throat. A collar that made Manon keep her distance. Such a wrong scent around all these people. Human, but also not human. And on this woman, the scent was strongest and strangest. Like the dark, forgotten places of the world. Like tilled soil in a graveyard.
"By next week I want reports on what the wild men of the Fangs are up to," the Duke said.
His well-groomed, rust-colored mustache seemed so at odds with his dark, brutal armor. A man equally comfortable battling in council rooms or on killing fields.
"Anything in particular to look for?" Manon said flatly, already bored.
It was an honor to be wing leader, she reminded herself. An honor to lead the Iron Teeth host. Even if being here felt like a punishment. And even if she hadn't yet received word from her grandmother, the High Witch of the Blackbeak clan, about what their next move was to be. They were allies with Otterlin, not lackeys at the king's beck and call. The Duke stroked an idle hand down Caltaine's thin arm, its white flesh marred with too many bruises to be accidental. And then there was the thick red scar just below the dip of her elbow, 2 inches long, slightly raised. It had to be recent. But the woman didn't flinch at the Duke's intimate touch, didn't show a flicker of pain as his thick fingers caressed the violent scar.
"I want an up-to-date list of their settlements," the Duke said. "Their numbers, the major paths they use to cross the mountains. Stay invisible, and do not engage."
Manon might have tolerated everything about being stuck in Morath, except for that last order. Do not engage. No killing. No fighting, no bleeding men. The council chamber had only one tall, narrow window, its view cut off by one of the many stone towers of Morath. Not enough open space in this room, not with the Duke and his broken woman beside him. Manon lifted her chin and stood.
"As you will it."
"Your grace,"
the Duke said. Manon paused, half turning. The Duke's dark eyes weren't wholly human.
"You will address me as your grace, wing leader."
It was an effort to keep her iron teeth from snapping down from the slits in her gums.
"You're not my duke," she said,
"nor are you my grace."
Asterin had gone still. Duke Parrington boomed out a laugh. Caltaine showed no indication that she'd heard any of it.
"The white demon,"
the Duke mused.
looking Manon over with eyes that roved too freely. Had he been anyone else, she would have gouged those eyes out with her iron nails, and let him scream for a bit before she ripped out his throat with her iron teeth. I wonder if you won't seize the host for yourself and snatch up my empire. I have no use for human lands. It was the truth. Only the Western Wastes, home of the once glorious Witch Kingdom. But until they fought in the King of Otterland's war, until his enemies were defeated, they would not be allowed to reclaim it. Besides, the Kraken curse that denied them true possession of the land held firm, and they were no closer to breaking it than Manon's elders had been 500 years ago, when the last Kraken queen damned them with her dying breath.
And for that I thank the gods every day.
He waved a hand.
Dismissed.
Manon stared him down, again debating the merits of slaughtering him right at the table, if only to see how Caltaine would react to that. But Asterin shifted her foot against the stone, as good as a pointed cough. So Manon turned from the Duke and his silent bride, and walked out. Manon stalked down the narrow halls of Morath Keep, Asterin flanking her, Sorrel a step behind, Vesta and Lynn bringing up the rear. Through every slitted window they passed, roars and wings and shouts burst in along with the final rays of the setting sun. And beyond them, the relentless striking of hammers on steel and iron. They passed a cluster of guards outside the entrance to the Duke's private tower, one of the few places where they weren't allowed. The smells that leaked from behind the door of dark, glittering stone raked claws down Manon's spine, and she and her second and third kept a wary distance. Asterin even went so far as to bare her teeth at the guards posted in front of that door, her golden hair and the rough leather band she wore across her brow glinting in the torchlight. The men didn't so much as blink, and their breathing didn't hitch. She knew their training had nothing to do with it. They had a reek to them, too. Manon glanced over her shoulder at Vesta, who was smirking at every guard and trembling servant they passed. Her red hair, creamy skin, and black and gold eyes were enough to stop most men in their tracks, to keep them distracted while she used them for pleasure, and then let them bleed out for amusement. But these guards yielded no reaction to her either. Vesta noticed Manon's attention and lifted her auburn brows.
Get the others, Manon ordered her. It's time for a hunt.
Vesta nodded and peeled away down a darkened hallway. She jerked her chin at Lynn, who gave Manon a wicked little grin and faded into the shadows on Vesta's heels. Manon and her second and third were silent as they ascended the half-crumbling tower that housed the 13's private aerie. By day, their wyverns perched on the massive posts jutting out from the tower's side to get some fresh air and to watch the war camp far, far below. By night, they hauled themselves into the aerie to sleep, chained in their assigned areas. It was far easier than locking them in the reeking cells in the belly of the mountain with the rest of the host's wyverns, where they would only rip each other to shreds and get cramps in their wings. They'd tried housing them there, just once upon arriving. Abraxos had gone berserk and taken out half his pen, rousing the other mounts until they too were bucking and roaring and threatening to bring the keep down around them. An hour later, Manon had commandeered this tower for the 13. It seemed that the strange scent riled Abraxos, too. But in the aerie, the reek of the animals was familiar, welcoming. Blood and shit and hay and leather, hardly a whiff of that off smell. Perhaps because they were so high up that the wind blew it away. The straw-coated floor crunched beneath their boots, a cool breeze sweeping in from where the roof had been ripped half off thanks to Sorrel's bull. To keep the wyverns from feeling less caged, and so Abraxos could watch the stars, as he liked to do. Manon ran an eye over the feeding troughs in the center of the chamber. None of the mounts touched the meat and grain provided by the mortal men who maintained the aerie. One of those men was laying down fresh hay, and a flash of Manon's iron teeth had him scurrying down the stairs, the tang of his fear lingering in the air like a smear of oil.
4 weeks,
Asterin said, glancing at her pale blue wyvern, visible on her perch through one of the many open archways.
4 weeks and no action. What are we even doing here? When will we move?
Indeed, the restrictions were grating on them all. Limiting flying to nighttime to keep the host mostly undetected. The stench of these men. The stone. The forges. The winding passages of the endless keep. They took little bites out of Manon's patience every day. Even the small mountain range in which the keep was nestled was dense, made only of bare rock, with few signs of the spring that had now blanketed most of the land. A dead, festering place. "We move when we're told to move," Manon said to Asterin, gazing toward the setting sun. Soon, as soon as that sun vanished over those jagged black peaks, they could take to the skies. Her stomach grumbled. "And if you're going to question orders, Asterin, then I'll be happy to replace you."
"I'm not questioning," Asterin said, holding Manon's gaze for longer than most witches dared. "But it's a waste of our skills to be sitting here like hens in a coop, at the Duke's bidding. I'd like to rip open that worm's belly."
Sorrel murmured, "I would advise you, Asterin, to resist the urge." Manon's tan-skinned third, built like a battering ram, kept her attention solely on the quick lethal movements of her second. The stone to Asterin's flame, ever since they'd been witchlings.
"The King of Otterland can't steal our mounts from us. Not now," Asterin said. "Perhaps we should move deeper into the mountains and camp there, where at least the air is clean. There's no point squatting here."
Sorrel let out a warning growl, but Manon jerked her chin, a silent order to stand down as she herself stepped closer to her second. "The last thing I need," Manon breathed in Asterin's face, "is to have that mortal swine question the suitability of my 13. Keep yourself in line. And if I hear you telling your scouts any of this..."
"You think I would speak ill of you to inferiors?"
A snap of iron teeth. "I think you and all of us are sick of being confined to this shithole. And you have a tendency to say what you think and consider the consequences later." Asterin had always been that way. And that wildness was exactly why Manon had chosen her as her second a century ago. The flame to Sorrel's stone, and to Manon's ice. The rest of the 13 began filing in as the sun vanished. They took one glance at Manon and Asterin and wisely kept away, their eyes averted. Vesta even muttered a prayer to the three-faced goddess.
"I want only for the 13, for all the Blackbeaks, to win glory on the battlefield," Asterin said, refusing to break Manon's stare.
"We will,"
Manon promised, loud enough for the others to hear. "But until then, keep yourself in check, or I'll ground you until you're worthy of riding with us again." Asterin lowered her eyes.
"Your will is mine, wing leader."
Coming from anyone else, even Sorrel, the honorific would have been normal, expected. Because none of them would ever have dared to cast that tone to it. Manon lashed out, so fast that even Asterin couldn't retreat. Manon's hand closed around her cousin's throat, her iron nails digging into the soft skin beneath her ears. "You step 1 foot out of line, Asterin, and these..." Manon dug her nails in deeper as blue blood began sliding down Asterin's golden tan neck.
"Find their mark."
Manon didn't care that they'd been fighting at each other's sides for a century, that Asterin was her closest relative, or that Asterin had gone to the mat again and again to defend Manon's position as heir. She'd put Asterin down the moment she became a useless nuisance. Manon let Asterin see all of that in her eyes. Asterin's gaze flicked to the blood-red cloak Manon wore, the cloak Manon's grandmother had ordered her to take from that Kraken after Manon slit her throat, after the witch bled out on the floor of the Omega. Asterin's beautiful, wild face went cold as she said,
"Understood."
Manon released her throat, flicking Asterin's blood off her nails as she turned to the 13, now standing by their mounts, stiff-backed and silent.
"We ride. Now."
Abraxos shifted and bobbed beneath Manon as she climbed into the saddle. well aware that one misstep off the wooden beam on which he was perched would lead to a very long, very permanent drop. Below and to the south, countless army campfires flickered, and the smoke of the forges among them rose high in plumes that marred the starry, moonlit sky. Abraxos growled.
"I know, I know. I'm hungry, too,"
Manon said, blinking the lid above her eye into place, as she secured the harnesses that kept her firmly in the saddle. To her left and right, Asterin and Sorrel mounted their wyverns and turned to her. Her cousin's wounds had already clotted. Manon gazed at the unforgiving plunge straight down the side of the tower, past the jagged rocks of the mountain, and into the open air beyond. Perhaps that was why these mortal fools had insisted that every wyvern and rider make the crossing at the Omega, so they could come to Morath and not balk at the sheer drop, even from the lowest levels of the keep. A chill, reeking wind brushed her face, clogging her nose. A pleading, hoarse scream broke from inside one of those hollowed-out mountains, then went silent. Time to go. If not to fill her belly, then to get away from the rot of this place for a few hours. Manon dug her legs into Abraxos's scarred, leathery side, and his spider-silk reinforced wings glittered like gold in the light of the fires far below.
"Fly, Abraxos," she breathed.
Abraxos sucked in a great breath, tucked his wings in tight, and fell off the side of the post. He liked to do that, just tumble off as though he'd been struck dead. Her wyvern, it seemed, had a wicked sense of humor. The first time he'd done it, she'd roared at him. Now he did it just to show off, as the wyverns of the rest of the 13 had to jump up and out and then plunge, their bodies too big to nimbly navigate the narrow drop. Manon kept her eyes open as they tumbled down, the wind battering them. Abraxos a warm mass beneath her. She liked to watch every stunned and terrified mortal face, liked to see how close Abraxos got to the stones of the tower, to the jagged black mountain rock before. Abraxos flung out his wings and banked hard, the world tilting and then shooting behind. He let out a fierce cry that reverberated over every stone of Morath, echoed by the shrieks of the 13's mounts. On a tower's exterior stairs, a servant hauling a basket of apples cried out and dropped his burden. The apples tumbled one by one by one down the steps winding around the tower, a cascade of red and green in time to the pounding of the forges. Then Abraxos was flapping up and away over the dark army, over the sharp peaks, the 13 falling smoothly into rank behind him. It was a strange sort of thrill, to ride like this, with just her coven, a unit capable of sacking whole cities by themselves. Abraxos flew hard and fast, he and Manon both scanning the earth as they broke free from the mountains and cruised over the flat farmland before the Acanthus River. Most humans had fled this region, or had been butchered for war or sport. But there were still a few, if you knew where to look. On and on they flew, the sliver of a crescent moon rising higher, the crone's sickle. A good night for hunting, if the unkind face of the goddess now watched over them, even though the dark of the new moon, the crone's shadow, was always preferred. At least the sickle gave off enough light to see by as Manon scanned the earth. Water. Mortals liked to live near water, so she headed toward a lake she'd spotted weeks ago but hadn't yet explored. Fast and sleek as shadows, the 13 soared over the night-shrouded land. At last, moonlight dimly glinted over a small body of water, and Abraxos glided for it, down and down, until Manon could see their reflection on the flat surface. See her red cape fluttering behind her like a trail of blood. Behind, Asterin whooped, and Manon turned to watch her second fling her arms out and lean back in her saddle until she was lying flat on her mount's spine, her golden hair unbound and streaming. Such wild ecstasy. There was always a fierce, untamed joy when Asterin flew. Manon occasionally wondered if her second sometimes snuck out at night to ride in nothing but her skin, forgoing even a saddle. Manon faced forward, frowning. Thank the darkness that the Blackbeak matron wasn't here to see this, or more than Asterin would be threatened. It would be Manon's own neck, too, for allowing such wildness to bloom, and being unwilling to stomp it out entirely. Manon spied a small cottage with a fenced field. A light flickered in the window. Perfect. Beyond the house, tufts of solid white gleamed, bright as snow. Even better. Manon steered Abraxos toward the farm, toward the family that, if they were smart, had heard the booming wings and taken cover. No children. It was an unspoken rule among the 13, even if some of the other clans had no qualms about it, especially the Yellow Legs. But men and women were fair game, if there was fun to be had. And after her earlier encounters with the Duke, with Asterin, Manon was truly in the mood for some amusement. Chapter 9. After Aelin wrote the damning letter to Aerobin and sent it via one of his feral street urchins, hunger dragged her from the apartment into the gray morning. Bone-tired, she hunted down breakfast, also buying enough for lunch and dinner, and returned to the warehouse an hour later to find a large, flat box waiting on the dining table. No sign of the lock having been tampered with. None of the windows open any farther than they'd been when she cracked them to let in the river breeze that morning. But she expected no less from Aerobin, no less than a reminder that he might be king of the assassins, but he'd clawed and slaughtered his way onto that self-made throne. It seemed fitting, somehow, that the skies opened up just then, the patter and clink of the downpour washing away the too heavy silence of the room. Aelin tugged at the emerald silk ribbon around the cream-colored box until it dropped away. Setting aside the lid, she stared at the folded cloth within for a long moment. The note placed atop it read, "I took the liberty of having some improvements made since the last time. Go play." Her throat tightened, but she pulled out the full bodysuit of black cloth, tight, thick, and flexible like leather, but without the sheen and suffocation. Beneath the folded suit lay a pair of boots. They'd been cleaned since the last time she'd worn them years ago. The black leather still supple and pliable, the special grooves and hidden blades as precise as ever. She lifted the heavy sleeve of the suit to reveal the built-in gauntlets that concealed thin, vicious swords as long as her forearm. She hadn't seen this suit, hadn't worn it since. She glanced at the empty spot on the mantle. Another test, a quiet one, to see just how much she would forgive and forget, how much she would stomach to work with him. Aerobin had paid for the suit years ago, an exorbitant fee demanded by a master tinkerer from Melisande, who had crafted it by hand, built exactly to her measurements. He'd insisted his two best assassins be outfitted in the stealthy, lethal suits, so hers had been a gift. One of many he'd heaped on her as reparation for beating her to hell, and then packing her off to the Red Desert to train. She and Sam had both taken brutal beatings for their disobedience. And yet Aerobin had made Sam pay for his suit, and then given him second-rate jobs to keep him from swiftly paying off the debt. She set the suit back in the box, and began undressing, breathing in the scent of rain on stone that wafted in through the open windows. Oh, she could play the devoted protege again. She could go along with the plan she'd let him create. The plan she'd modify slightly, just enough. She'd kill whoever was needed. Whore herself, wreck herself, if it meant getting Adian to safety. 2 days, just 2 days until she could see him again, until she could see with her own eyes that he'd made it, that he'd survived all these years they'd been apart. And even if Adian hated her, spat on her as Kaol had practically done, it would be worth it. Naked, she stepped into the suit, the smooth, slick material whispering against her skin. Typical of Aerobin not to mention what modifications he'd made, to make it a lethal puzzle for her to sort out, if she was clever enough to survive. She shimmied into it, careful to avoid triggering the mechanism that brought forth those hidden blades, feeling for any other concealed weapons or tricks. It was the work of another moment before the suit enveloped her completely, and she buckled her feet into the boots. As she headed for the bedroom, she could already sense the reinforcement added to every weak spot she possessed. The specifications must have been sent months before the suit arrived. By the man who did indeed know about the knee that sometimes twanged, the body parts she favored in combat, the speed with which she moved. All of Aerobin's knowledge of her, wrapped around her in cloth and steel and darkness. She paused before the standing mirror against the far wall of the bedroom. A second skin. Perhaps made less scandalous by the exquisite detailing, the extra padding, the pockets, the bits of armored decoration. But there was not one inch left to the imagination. She let out a low whistle. Very well, then. She could be Selena Sardothian again. For a little longer. Until this game was finished. She might have brooded over it more had splashing hooves and wheels halting outside the warehouse not echoed through the open windows. She doubted Aerobin would show up so soon to gloat. No, he'd wait until he learned whether she actually went to play with the suit. That left one other person who'd bother to come by, though she doubted Kaol would waste money on a carriage, even in the rain. Keeping away from sight, she peered out the window through the downpour, taking in the details of the nondescript carriage. No one on the rainy street to observe it, and no sign of who might be within. Heading for the door, Aelin flicked her wrist, releasing the blade on her left arm. It made no sound as it shot free from the hidden slot in the gauntlet, the metal gleaming in the rain-dim light. Gods, the suit was as wondrous as it had been that first day she tried it on, the blade cutting as smoothly through the air as it had when she'd plunged it into her targets. Her footsteps and the drumming of the rain on the warehouse roof were the only sounds as she descended the stairs, and padded between the crates piled high on the main floor. Left arm angled to hide the blade within the folds of her cloak, she hauled open the giant rolling warehouse door to reveal the veils of rain billowing past. A cloaked woman waited under the narrow awning, an unmarked hansom cab for hire loitering behind her on the curb. The driver was watching carefully, rain dripping off the broad rim of his hat, not a trained eye, just looking out for the woman who'd hired him. Even in the rain, her cloak was a deep, rich gray, the fabric clean and heavy enough to suggest lots of money, despite the carriage. The heavy hood concealed the stranger's face in shadow, but Aelin glimpsed ivory skin, dark hair, and fine velvet gloves reaching into her cloak. For a weapon? "Start explaining," Aelin said, leaning against the doorframe. "Or your rat meat." The woman stepped back into the rain. Not back, exactly, but toward the carriage, where Aelin noted the small form of a child waiting inside, cowering. The woman said, "I came to warn you," and pulled back her hood just enough to reveal her face. Large, slightly up-tilted green eyes, sensuous lips, sharp cheekbones, and a pert nose combined to create a rare, staggering beauty that caused men to lose all common sense. Aelin stepped under the narrow awning and drawled, "As far as memory serves me, Lysandra, I warned you that if I ever saw you again, I'd kill you."
"Please," Lysandra begged.
That word, and the desperation behind it, made Aelin slide her blade back into its sheath. In the 9 years that she'd known the courtesan, never once had she heard Lysandra say please or sound desperate for anything at all. Phrases like "thank you," "may I," or even "lovely to see you" had never been uttered by Lysandra within Aelin's hearing. They could have been friends as easily as enemies, both of them orphaned, both found by Aerobin as children. But Aerobin had handed Lysandra over to Clarice, his good friend and a successful brothel madam. And though Aelin had been trained for killing fields and Lysandra for bedrooms, they'd somehow grown up rivals, clawing for Aerobin's favor. When Lysandra turned 17 and had her bidding, it was Aerobin who had won, using the money Aelin had given him to pay off her own debts. The courtesan had then thrown what Aerobin had done with Aelin's blood money in her face. So Aelin had thrown something back at her, a dagger. They hadn't seen each other since. Aelin figured she was perfectly justified in tugging back her hood to reveal her own face and saying, "It would take me less than a minute to kill you and your driver, and to make sure your little protege in the carriage doesn't say a peep about it. She'd probably be happy to see you dead.
Lysandra stiffened. She is not my protege, and she is not in training.
So she's to be used as a shield against me? Aelin's smile was razor sharp.
Please,
please,
Lysandra said over the rain. I need to talk to you, just for a few minutes, where it's safe.
Aelin took in the fine clothes, the hired cab, the rain splashing on the cobblestones. So typical of Aerobin to throw this at her. But she let him play this hand, see where it got her. Aelin squeezed the bridge of her nose with two fingers, then lifted her head.
You know I have to kill your driver.
No, you don't, the man cried, scrambling to grab the reins. I swear I won't breathe a word about this place.
Aelin stalked to the hansom cab, the rain instantly soaking her cloak. The driver could report the location of the warehouse, could endanger everything, but... Aelin peered at the rain-flecked cab permit framed by the door, illuminated by the little lantern hanging above. Well, Kellen Opal of 63 Baker Street, Apartment 2, I suppose you won't tell anyone. White as death. The driver nodded. Aelin yanked open the carriage door, saying to the child within,
Get out.
Both of you inside, now.
Evangeline can wait here,
Lysandra whispered. Aelin looked over her shoulder, rain splattering her face as her lips pulled back from her teeth. If you think for one moment that I'm leaving a child alone in a hired carriage in the slums,
you can go right back to the cesspit you came from.
She peered into the carriage again and said to the cowering girl, Come on, you. I won't bite. That seemed to be enough assurance for Evangeline, who scooted closer, the lantern light gilding her tiny porcelain hand before she gripped Aelin's arm to hop from the cab. No more than 11, she was delicately built, her red-gold hair braided back to reveal citrine eyes that gobbled up the drenched street and women before her. As stunning as her mistress. Or would have been, were it not for the deep, jagged scars on both cheeks. Scars that explained the hideous branded-out tattoo on the inside of the girl's wrist. She'd been one of Clarice's acolytes, until she'd been marred and lost all value. Aelin winked at Evangeline, and said with a conspirator's grin as she led her through the rain, You look like my sort of person. Aelin propped open the rest of the windows to let the rain-cooled river breeze into the stuffy apartment. Thankfully, no one had been on the street in the minutes they'd been outside. But if Lysandra was here, she had no doubt it would get back to Aerobin. Aelin patted the armchair before the window, smiling at the brutally scarred little girl. This is my favorite place to sit in the whole apartment when there's a nice breeze coming through. If you want, I have a book or two that I think you'd like. Or, she gestured to the kitchen to her right, you might be able to find something delicious on the kitchen table. Blueberry tart, I think. Lysandra was stiff, but Aelin didn't particularly give a damn as she added to Evangeline, Your choice. As a child in a high-end brothel, Evangeline had probably had too few choices in her short life. Lysandra's green eyes seemed to soften a bit, and Evangeline said, her voice barely audible above the patter of the rain on the roof and windows,
I would like a tart, please.
A moment later, she was gone. Smart girl, to know to stay out of her mistress's way. With Evangeline occupied, Aelin slung off her soaked cloak and used the small remaining dry section to wipe her wet face. Keeping her wrist angled in case she needed to draw the hidden blade, Aelin pointed to the couch before the unlit fire and told Lysandra, Sit. To her surprise, the woman obeyed, but then said,
Or you'll threaten to kill me again?
I don't make threats, only promises. The courtesan slumped against the couch cushions.
Please, how can I ever take anything that comes out of that big mouth seriously?
You took it seriously when I threw a dagger at your head. Lysandra gave her a little smile.
You missed.
True, but she'd still grazed the courtesan's ear. As far as she'd been concerned, it had been deserved. But it was a woman sitting before her. They were both women now. Not the girls they'd been at 17, Lysandra looked her up and down.
I prefer you as a blonde.
I prefer you get the hell out of my house, but that doesn't seem likely to happen anytime soon. She glanced at the street below. The cab lingered, as ordered. Aerobin couldn't send you in one of his carriages? I thought he was paying you handsomely. Lysandra waved her hand, the candlelight catching on a golden bracelet that barely covered a snake-like tattoo stamped on her slender wrist.
I refused his carriage. I thought it had set the wrong tone.
Too late for that. So he did send you, then? To warn me about what, exactly?
He sent me to tell you his plan. He doesn't trust messengers these days. But the warning comes from me.
An utter lie, no doubt. But that tattoo, the sigil of Clarissa's brothel, etched on the flesh of all her courtesans from the moment they were sold into her house, the girl in the kitchen, the driver below, they could make everything very, very difficult if she'd gutted Lysandra. But the dagger was tempting as she beheld that tattoo.
Not the sword.
No. She wanted the intimacy of a knife. Wanted to share breath with the courtesan as she ended her. Aelin asked too quietly,
Why do you still have Clarissa's sigil tattooed on you?
Do not trust Archer.
Nehemia had tried to warn her, drawing a perfect rendering of the snake in her coded message. But what about anyone else with that sigil? The Lysandra that Aelin had known years ago. Two-faced, lying, and conniving were among the nicer words Aelin had used to describe her. Lysandra frowned down at it.
We don't get it stamped out until we've paid off our debts.
The last time I saw your whoring carcass, you were weeks away from paying them off. Indeed, Aerobin had paid so much at the bidding 2 years ago that Lysandra should have been free almost immediately. The courtesan's eyes flickered.
Do you have a problem with the tattoo?
That piece of shit Archer Finn had one. They belonged to the same house. The same madam. Maybe they'd worked together in other regards, too. Lysandra held her gaze.
Archer's dead.
Because I gutted him, Aelin said sweetly. Lysandra braced a hand on the back of the couch.
You?
She breathed. But then she shook her head and said softly,
Good. Good that you killed him. He was a self-serving pig.
It could be a lie to win her over. Say your piece and then get out. Lysandra's sensuous mouth tightened, but she laid out Aerobin's plan to free Adian.
It was brilliant,
if Aelin felt like being honest. Clever and dramatic and bold. If the King of Otterlin wanted to make a spectacle of Adian's execution, then they would make a spectacle of his rescue. But to tell her through Lysandra, to draw in another person who might betray her or stand witness against her, one more reminder of how easily Adian's fate could be sealed. Should Aerobin decide to make Aelin's life a living hell?
I know, the courtesan said,
taking in the cold gleam in Aelin's eyes.
You needn't remind me that you'll skin me alive if I betray you.
Aelin felt a muscle flicker in her cheek. And the warning you came to give me? Lysandra shifted on the couch.
Aerobin wanted me to tell you the plan so that I might check up on you, test you, see how much you're on his side. See if you're going to betray him.
I'd be disappointed if he didn't.
I think he also sent me here as an offering.
Aelin knew what she meant, but she said, Unfortunately for you, I don't have any interest in women, even when they're paid for. Lysandra's nostrils flared delicately.
I think he sent me here so you could kill me, as a present.
And you came to beg me to reconsider?
No wonder she'd brought the child, then.
The selfish, spineless coward, to use Evangeline as a shield, to bring a child into this world of theirs. Lysandra glanced at the knife strapped to Aelin's thigh.
Kill me if you want. Evangeline already knows what I suspect, and won't say a word.
Aelin willed her face into a mask of icy calm.
But I did come to warn you, Lysandra went on. He might offer you presents, might help you with this rescue. But he is having you watched, and he has his own agenda. That favor you offered him? He didn't tell me what it is, but it's likely to be a trap in one way or another. I consider whether his help is worth it, and see if you can get out of it.
She wouldn't.
Couldn't. Not for about a dozen different reasons.
When Aelin didn't respond, Lysandra took a sharp breath.
I also came to give you this.
She reached a hand into the folds of her rich indigo gown, and Aelin subtly shifted into a defensive position. Lysandra merely pulled out a worn, faded envelope and gingerly set it on the low table before the couch. It shook the whole way down.
This is for you. Please read it.
So you're Erebin's whore and courier now? The courtesan took the verbal slap.
This isn't from Erebin. It's from Wesley.
Lysandra seemed to sink into the couch, and there was such an unspeakable grief in her eyes that for a moment, Aelin believed it. Wesley, Aelin said. Erebin's bodyguard. The one who spent most of his time hating me and the rest of it contemplating ways to kill me. The courtesan nodded. Erebin murdered Wesley for killing Rourke Farron. Lysandra flinched. Aelin glanced at the old envelope. Lysandra dropped her gaze to her hands, clutched together so tightly that her knuckles were bone white. Worn lines marred the envelope, but the chipped seal had yet to be broken.
Why have you been carrying a letter to me from Wesley for almost 2 years?
Lysandra wouldn't look up, and her voice broke as she said,
Because I loved him very much.
Well, of all the things she'd expected Lysandra to say.
It started off as a mistake. Erebin would send me back to Clarice's with him in the carriage as an escort, and at first we were just friends. We talked, and he expected nothing. But then Sam died, and you...
Lysandra jerked her chin at the letter, still lying unopened between them.
It's all in there. Everything Erebin did, everything he planned, what he asked Farron to do to Sam, and what he ordered done to you. All of it. Wesley wanted you to know, because he wanted you to understand. He needed you to understand, Selena, that he didn't know until it was too late. He tried to stop it, and did the best he could to avenge Sam. If Erebin hadn't killed him... Wesley was planning to go to Endovir to get you out. He even went to the Shadow Market to find someone who knew the layout of the mines, and got a map of them. I still have it, as proof. I can go get it.
The words slammed into her like a barrage of arrows, but she shut out the sorrow for a man she had never taken the time to consider as anything but one of Erebin's dogs. She wouldn't put it past Erebin to use Lysandra, to make up this entire story to get her to trust the woman. The Lysandra she'd known would have been more than happy to do it, and Aelin could have played along just to learn where it would take her, what Erebin was up to, and whether he'd trip up enough to reveal his hand. But... what he asked Farron to do to Sam. She'd always assumed Farron had just tortured Sam in the way he so loved to hurt and break people. But for Erebin to request specific things be done to Sam, it was good she didn't have her magic. Good it was stifled. Because she might have erupted into flames and burned for days, cocooned in her fire. So you came here, Aelin said, as Lysandra discreetly wiped at her eyes with a handkerchief, to warn me that Erebin might be manipulating me, because you finally realized what a monster Erebin truly is after he killed your lover?
I promised Wesley I would personally give you that letter.
Well, you gave it to me, so get out. Light footsteps sounded, and Evangeline burst from the kitchen, rushing to her mistress with a quiet, nimble grace, with surprising tenderness. Lysandra slipped a reassuring arm around Evangeline as she rose to her feet.
I understand, Selena. I do. But I am begging you. Read that letter. For him.
Aelin bared her teeth. Get out. Lysandra walked to the door, keeping herself and Evangeline a healthy distance from Aelin. She paused in the doorway.
Sam was my friend, too. He and Wesley were my only friends.
And Erebin took them both away. Aelin just raised her brows. Lysandra didn't bother with a goodbye as she vanished down the stairs. But Evangeline lingered on the threshold, glancing between her disappearing mistress and Aelin, her lovely hair glimmering like liquid copper. Then the girl gestured to her scarred face and said,
"She did this to me."
It was an effort to keep seated, to keep from leaping down the stairs to slit Lysandra's throat. But Evangeline went on.
"I cried when my mother sold me to Clarice. Cried and cried. And I think Lysandra had annoyed the mistress that day, because they gave me to her as an acolyte, even though she was weeks away from paying her debts. That night I was supposed to begin training, and I cried so hard I made myself sick. But Lysandra, she cleaned me up. She told me that there was a way out, but it would hurt, and I would not be the same. I couldn't run, because she had tried running a few times when she was my age, and they had found her and beat her where no one could see."
She had never known, never wondered. All those times she had sneered at and mocked Lysandra while they'd grown up. Evangeline continued.
"I said I'd do anything to get out of what the other girls had told me about. So she told me to trust her, and then gave me these. She started shouting loud enough for the others to come running. They thought she cut me out of anger, and she said she'd done it to keep me from being a threat. And she let them believe it. Clarice was so mad that she beat Lysandra in the courtyard. But Lysandra didn't cry. Not once. And when the healer said my face couldn't be fixed, Clarice made Lysandra buy me for the amount I would have cost if I had been a full courtesan, like her."
Aelin had no words. Evangeline said,
"That's why she's still working for Clarice. Why she's still not free. And won't be for a while. I thought you should know."
Aelin wanted to tell herself not to trust the girl, that this could be part of Lysandra and Arobin's plan. But there was a voice in her head, in her bones, that whispered to her, over and over and over, each time clearer and louder. Nehemia would have done the same. Evangeline curtsied and went down the stairs, leaving Aelin staring at the worn envelope. If she herself could change so much in 2 years, perhaps so could Lysandra. And for a moment, she wondered how another young woman's life would have been different if she had stopped to talk to her. Really talk to Caltaine Rompier, instead of dismissing her as a vapid courtier. What would have happened if Nehemia had tried to see past Caltaine's mask, too? Evangeline was climbing into the rain-gleaming carriage beside Lysandra, when Aelin appeared at the warehouse door and said, "Wait." Chapter 10. Adian's vision was swimming, his every breath gloriously difficult. Soon, he could feel death squatting in the corner of his cell, counting down the last of his breaths, a lion waiting to pounce. Every so often, Adian would smile toward those gathered shadows. The infection had spread, and with 2 days until the spectacle at which he was to be executed, his death was coming none too soon. The guards assumed he was sleeping to pass the time. Adian was waiting for his food, watching the small barred window in the top of the cell door for any sign of the guard's arrival. But he was fairly sure he was hallucinating when the door opened, and the crown prince strolled in. There were no guards behind him, no sign of any escort as the prince stared from the doorway. The prince's unmoving face told him immediately what he needed to know. This was not a rescue attempt. And the black stone collar around the prince's throat told him everything else. Things had not gone well the day Sorsha had been murdered. He managed to grin. "Good to see you, princeling." The prince ran an eye over Adian's dirty hair, the beard that had grown during the past few weeks, and then over to the pile of vomit in the corner from when he hadn't been able to make it to the bucket an hour ago. Adian drawled as best he could, "The least you could do is take me to dinner before looking at me like that." The prince's sapphire eyes flicked to his, and Adian blinked past the haze covering his vision. What studied him was cold, predatory, and not quite human. Quietly, Adian said, "Dorian." The thing that was now the prince smiled a little. The captain had said those rings of wordstone enslaved the mind, the soul. He'd seen the collar waiting beside the king's throne, and had wondered if it was the same, worse.
"Tell me what happened in the throne room, Dorian."
Adian wheezed, his head pounding. The prince blinked slowly.
Nothing happened.
Why are you here, Dorian?
Adian had never addressed the prince by his given name, but using it, reminding him, somehow seemed important, even if it only provoked the prince into killing him.
I came to look at the infamous general before they execute you like an animal.
No chance of being killed today, then.
The same way they executed your Sorsha?
Though the prince didn't move, Adian could have sworn he recoiled, as if someone yanked on a leash, as if there was still someone in need of leashing.
I don't know what you're talking about,
the thing inside the prince said, but its nostrils flared.
Sorsha,
Adian breathed, his lungs aching.
Sorsha, your woman, the healer. I was standing beside you when they cut off her head. I heard you screaming as you dove for her body.
The thing went a bit rigid, and Adian pressed.
Where did they bury her, Dorian? What did they do with her body? The body of the woman you loved.
I don't know what you're talking about, it said again.
Sorsha,
Adian panted, his breathing uneven.
Her name was Sorsha, and she loved you, and they killed her. The man who put that collar around your neck killed her.
The thing was quiet, then it tilted its head. The smile it gave him was horrifying in its beauty.
I shall enjoy watching you die, General.
Adian coughed out a laugh. The prince, the thing he'd become, turned smoothly and strode out. And Adian might have laughed again for spite and defiance, had he not heard the prince say to someone in the hall,
"The general is sick. See to it that he's attended to immediately."
No. The thing must have smelled it on him. Adian could do nothing as a healer was summoned, an older woman named Amethy. And he was held down, too weak to fight back as she attended his wounds. She shoved a tonic down his throat that made him choke. His wound was washed and bound, and his shackles were shortened until he couldn't move his hands enough to rip out the stitching. The tonics kept coming, every hour, no matter how hard he bit, no matter how forcefully he tried to clamp his mouth shut. So they saved him, and Adian cursed and swore at death for failing him, even as he silently prayed to Mala Lightbringer to keep Aelin away from the party, away from the prince, and away from the king and his wordstone callers. The thing inside him left the dungeons and headed into the glass castle, steering his body like a ship. And now it forced him to be still as they stood before the man he often saw in those moments that pierced through the darkness. The man was seated on a glass throne, smiling faintly as he said,
"Bow."
The thing inside him yanked hard on their bond, lightning spearing his muscles, ordering them to obey. It was how he'd been forced to descend into those dungeons, where that golden-haired warrior had said her name. Said her name so many times that he began screaming, even if he made no sound. He was still screaming as his muscles betrayed him yet again, bringing him to his knees, the tendons on his neck lashing with pain, forcing him to bow his head.
"Still resisting?"
the man said, glancing at the dark ring on his finger as though it possessed the answer already.
"I can feel both of you in there. Interesting."
Yes, that thing in the darkness was growing stronger, now able to reach through the invisible wall between them and puppet him, speak through him, but not entirely, not for long amounts of time. He patched up the holes as best he could, but it kept breaking through. Demon. A demon prince. And he saw that moment, over and over and over, when the woman he'd loved had lost her head. Hearing her name on the general's raspy tongue had made him start wailing on the other wall in his mind, the barrier that kept him locked in the dark. But the darkness in his mind was a sealed tomb. The man on the throne said,
"Report."
The command shuddered through him, and he spit out the details of his encounter, every word and action. And the thing, the demon, delighted in his horror at it.
"Clever of Adian to try to quietly die on me,"
the man said.
He must think his cousin has a good chance of arriving at your party, then, if he's so desperate to rob us of our entertainment.
He kept silent, as he had not been instructed to speak. The man looked him over, those black eyes full of delight.
I should have done this years ago. I don't know why I wasted so much time waiting to see whether you'd have any power. Foolish of me.
He tried to speak, tried to move, tried to do anything with that mortal body of his, but the demon gripped his mind like a fist, and the muscles of his face slid into a smile, as he said,
It is my pleasure to serve, Majesty.
Chapter 11. The Shadow Market had operated along the banks of the Avery for as long as Rifthold had existed. Maybe longer. Legend claimed it had been built on the bones of the God of Truth so that it would keep the vendors and would-be thieves honest. Kaol supposed it was ironic, considering there was no God of Truth, as far as he knew. Contraband, illicit substances, spices, clothes, flesh. The market catered to any and all clientele, if they were brave or foolish or desperate enough to venture inside. When he'd first come here weeks ago, Kaol had been all of those things. As he climbed down the half-rotted wooden stairs from a crumbling section of the docks into the embankment itself, where alcoves and tunnels and shops were tunneled into the riverbank. Cloaked, armed figures patrolled the long, broad quay that served as the only path to the market. During rainy periods, the Avery would often rise high enough to flood the quay, and sometimes unlucky merchants and shoppers drowned inside the labyrinth of the Shadow Market. During drier months, you never knew what or who you might find selling their wares, or meandering through the dirty, damp tunnels. The market was packed tonight, even after a day of rain. A small relief. And another small relief, as thunder reverberated through the subterranean warren, setting everyone murmuring. The vendors and lowlifes would be too busy preparing for the storm to take notice of Kaol and Nezrin, as they strode down one of the main passageways. The thunder rattled the hanging lanterns of colored glass, strangely beautiful, as if someone had once been determined to give this place some loveliness. That served as the main lights in the brown caverns, casting plenty of those shadows the market was so notorious for. Shadows for dark dealings, shadows to slip a knife between the ribs, or to spirit someone away. Or for conspirators to meet. No one had bothered them as they'd slipped through one of the rough holes that served as an entrance to the Shadow Market's tunnels. They connected to the sewers somewhere, and he would bet that the more established vendors possessed their own secret exits beneath their stalls or shops. Vendor after vendor had set up stalls of wood or stone, with some wares displayed on tables or crates or in baskets, but most valuable goods hidden. A spice dealer offered everything from saffron to cinnamon, but even the most fragrant spices couldn't conceal the cloyingly sweet stench of the opium stashed beneath his displays. Once, long ago, Kaol might have cared about the illegal substances, about the vendors selling whatever they pleased. He might have bothered to try to shut this place down. Now they were nothing but resources. As a city guard, Nezrin probably felt the same way, even if just by being in here she was jeopardizing her own safety. This was a neutral zone, but its denizens didn't take kindly to authority. He didn't blame them. The Shadow Market had been one of the first places the King of Otterlin had purged after magic vanished, seeking out vendors who claimed to have banned books or still working charms and potions, as well as magic wielders desperate for a cure or a glimmer of magic. The punishments hadn't been pretty. Kaol almost heaved a sigh of relief when he spotted the two cloaked figures with a spread of knives for sale at a makeshift stand tucked into a dark corner. Exactly where they'd planned, and they'd done a hell of a job making it look authentic. Nezrin slowed her steps, pausing at various vendors. No more than a bored shopper killing time until the rain ceased. Kaol kept close to her, his weapons and prowling gait enough to deter any foolish pickpockets from trying their luck. The punch he'd taken to his ribs earlier that night made maintaining his crawling pace and scowl all the easier.
He and a few others had interrupted a Vogue commander in the midst of dragging a young man into the tunnels, and Kaol had been so damn distracted by Dorian, by what Aelin had said and done, that he'd been sloppy. So he'd earned that blow to the ribs, and the painful reminder of it each time he drew breath. No distractions, no slip-ups. Not when there was so much to do.